This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to the New Books Network Library Science Channel. My name is Hillel Yadin. I'm your host for this episode, and I am here with Mark V. Campbell and Murray Foreman, the co-editors, I guess, of Hip Hop Archives, The Politics and Poetics of Knowledge Production. Would you like to introduce yourselves and the book?
Sure. I mean, Murray, would you like to lead us off here?
I'll jump in. My name is Murray Foreman. I'm a professor of media and screen studies at Northeastern University. I've worked generally and, broadly in media, but I've looked at popular music and media, and then more specifically within that range since almost 30 years working on hip hop. Within a media and music industry context. I'm co-editor of three editions now of That's the Joint, the Hip Hop Studies Reader. And just a lot of interest and research in hip hop over the course of my career.
And I'm Mark V. Campbell. This is my second edited collection on hip hop. My first one is We Still Hear Hip Hop, North of the 49th Parallel, focuses on hip hop in Canada. And my monograph came after that, Afrosonic Life. And I'm a DJ and a curator. And I've been in Toronto all my life and been part of the hip hop scene here, hosting radio shows, DJing at events, throwing events, etc., and archiving Canadian hip hop history.
Wonderful. Thank you both. Listeners, this is my first interview with more than one author, so we'll see how this next part of the question goes. Do you want to talk about the book?
Let's chat about the book. When we started this book, it was both living in a different world. We were all in a different world, and it was something that we had to get cracking in the middle of the pandemic. But we knew that there were not very many people writing about archiving hip hop, but there were lots of people engaged in preserving it, either officially or unofficially. We know people in communities that had collections, but they weren't necessarily donated to libraries. And then we knew that there were, institutions, largely connected to Ivy League universities that had hip hop archival collections. So we thought we can't keep seeing this happen on the ground and not really provided with any kind of rigorous academic attention.
Mm-hmm. For me, being in the Boston area and adjacent to Harvard is among the first to have the Harvard Hip Hop Archive and Research Institute. And while it's more of a research institute, I'd say, than an actual hands-on archive, certainly having that term in their title, and having a kind of an archival intent at some level was important. And then not being too very, very far away from Cornell, which has the Cornell Hip Hop Collection, which at this point I would say is the kind of the gold standard in terms of collecting, archiving, making available hip hop artifacts. So I've been able to, I was able to go and spend time at both of those. And then Mark and I were just becoming aware of every city of scale had something going on of an archival nature, and we were trying to document it, follow it on their websites and that sort of thing, and at the same time wondering what's going on internationally, not just wanting to have a U.S. or Canada, North America centric kind of perspective, which often does happen with hip hop studies. So we pulled from our networks and things that were going on elsewhere. And trying to, put the question out there: what's going on? What in terms of hip hop archiving is being done in your country, in your region, in your locale, in your city? And we were really impressed with how much interest there was and how much activity there was. We couldn't include everything in the book. There was more. There were more people saying, we'd like to be included. We'd like to tell our story too.
Yeah, and we couldn't get all the stories, and there are far more stories, far more archivists and collectors and scholars that we just couldn't get into the book. Yeah.
Maybe there'll be a second edition.
Murray's smiling. I think he would love
Yeah.
that.
The North America centrism is certainly a persistent problem in archival studies as well. So it was really great to see the breadth of the collections and practitioners that were represented in the book. Maybe to that end, this is a question that I always ask people who put together edited volumes. Does the final product, does this book align with what you were initially envisioning when you embarked upon this project? And was there anything surprising about the submissions you actually ended up receiving?
I mean, I don't know if we had a real clear vision of what the final product might look like. There's a couple of reasons for that. When we really sort of got this going and put out the call for papers, it was immediately before the pandemic broke loose. And so right away, I think with so many things in the world, any preconceived notion you might have had of where you might be going with something fell apart. Or got derailed. So we're just glad that something at all came out of it, to be honest. But one of the things that we did start looking at is what are the scale of archival projects did we want to be looking at? Did we want to be looking at simply larger institutional type of situations and scenarios, or did we want to try and cast the net a little bit more widely and sort of say, like, what is an archive, and at what point maybe does a collection have a pre-archival possibility and potential? And once we, even though the pandemic, erupted and changed a lot of things, we were, and in fact, we lost a few people because of the pandemic. People who lost their access. I mentioned this in the afterword. Lost their access to the archives that they were going to be researching, or had familial responsibilities that they just couldn't overcome, in order to do their chapter or contribute. But what we did is we sort of looked at the different scale of things, and we really did, I think, capture from my perspective, capture some of the things from the larger institutional undertakings, like the level of the Cornell and the Ivy League institutions, all the way down to what people do have in their bedrooms, in their closets, in their attics, their basements, that sort of thing. And I think that's important to try and capture the fullness of it. And so in that regard, that's what I idealized, that's what I was aiming and hoping for, and I think we managed to pull that part off.
Yeah, and the piece about artists, like we made sure that artists had a strong voice in the book, and we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a bunch of detached folks that weren't on the ground practicing art aspects and art forms in hip hop culture. So that piece was wonderful to keep the, you know, the artists in the mix and allow their voices to reverberate throughout multiple chapters. But, you know, for me, one of the things that I wanted to see come out of this book was to expand the network of who's talking about this. There was no public discourse about a level of criticality around the archival discourse, you know, and we've managed to, you know, from 2010 when I had my first exhibition in Toronto. It was Toronto's first hip hop exhibition, like of historical items, and Murray was there. And there was nobody to bounce ideas off besides Murray because he came to Toronto and he saw what I was doing and is like, you know, who cares about these things besides me? And now there are folks in Sweden that care. There's folks that are, you know, connected to the Philippines and the former Yugoslavia and East Germany that I could call up and say, hey, here's a real scenario that, you know, here's a difficulty I'm having with, you know, obtaining. You know, you name it, you know, original photographs of graffiti pieces that are now eroded or something. So that for me has been in a selfish kind of way, it's been great to have more public criticality, you know, around archival discourse that has an impact on hip hop culture. But in terms of the book, we definitely wanted to get outside of North America. There were some continents we didn't get, we weren't able to get submissions from. So, you know, all in all, I think we did a fairly decent job of breaking ground. There was also no model for us to follow. So, you know, we started this conversation, and it's important that we made sure the global north and the global south were both in this conversation, you know, to the best of our abilities.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that a number of contributors, I'll keep bringing it back to archival studies because that's where I'm coming from. A number of contributors talk about this. There wasn't really anything, any base of scholarship in hip hop archiving for sure. And just in general, this kind of performance archiving, music archiving, this is, I think, underdeveloped in the archival world, period. So it's not, there was, I imagine, just not a ton of stuff you could draw from.
I would dispute that a little bit because in terms of some of the popular music and music heritage work, there's quite a bit being done in England. And here I'm pointing rather specifically, although it's more widespread than that, but people at the University of Liverpool. You know, looking at, you know, the Liverpool as the home of the Beatles and you know, having a rich musical heritage, and also its historical role, its racial history, all of these sort of things that Liverpool as an archival site is and was quite fascinating. And so there's a number of people, I think, coming from, you know, the tradition, British cultural studies tradition. And they've looked at music heritage. Now, it's not precisely archive, and I don't think they were necessarily always calling it archival in their work, more of a kind of music heritage approach. But there's a lot out there. People like Sarah Baker, Marion Leonard, Les Roberts, Sarah Cohen, and you know, there are others as well. And so with my foundation and footing in popular music studies, and then knowing some of these people, at least as email contacts, if not personally, that I did have people that I could reach out to, and they made recommendations of material and approaches and that sort of thing. And I think that was really kind of helpful to us. And of course, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the absence was there's nothing about hip hop represented in this work. And as Mark says, we're kind of at the first, we're pioneers helping to usher this into maybe an archival realm. But it wasn't like we were going completely without a map, that the popular music heritage people had sort of shown a little bit of a way to proceed.
Thank you for that. Listeners, I will link some of those scholars that Murray just mentioned and some work out of the University of Liverpool. I'll look into that so that we have those in the episode notes. There are certainly particular challenges to archiving. music, performance, anything sort of time-based and ephemeral. And a couple more than several contributors cited a performance studies scholar named Diana Taylor, and more than one specifically referenced one concept of hers, which is this tension between the archive and the repertoire. Can you speak to that tension in hip hop archives specifically?
Sure. I mean, this has been generative for my work, and I've been publishing, probably for about a decade or so on hip hop archives. And what I love about Diana Taylor, and she's rightfully well cited, is that what becomes really clear is that there's an official way to preserve things that requires institutional structures like libraries. And the bricks and mortar archive. And then there's another half of the world that preserves through performance, through song, through dance. And that understanding that divide is really helpful in terms of allowing archival theory to understand its limits. And then when and to practice and engage multiple forms of preservation, which people are doing all the time on the ground. So it's really helpful when you're thinking about hip hop as a multidisciplinary form. There, it's not just oral, it's not just physical kinesthetic, it's not just visual, it's all of them at the same time sometimes. And trying to understand how to preserve that art form. If you were to try to fit hip hop into this kind of linear archival historical record that's indebted to Enlightenment thinking, then you end up with boxes and papers. And if you and if you engage the idea of repertoire, then you end up with elders that have dance moves. And you end up with elders that have lyrics. You end up listening in in one of my last experiences in the arc in an institutional archive. Charlie Ahearn, who's the producer of this DVD called Wild Style, it's like a cult classic hip hop film, one of the first that went around the world. He's interviewing someone and he's talking about, I don't know if I told this story, Murray, but he's talking about Easy Mo B and the 1981 rap convention. And one thing just hits me. He's like, Easy Mo B, he's like an archive of rhymes because he's still spitting the same rhymes from 81. Like it, these are just these small rhyming couplets just over the beat and whatever. These aren't like verses and like, well-developed rhymes that you'd have today. And it just, Diana Taylor popped into my head and I was thinking, wow, what if we were to think about all of the ways that MCs memorize a whole set of lyrics from decades and decades ago and how they preserve those and how they reuse them in their new rhymes? Because there is this internal citational process happening in hip hop that's very different than the sampling that producers are doing. MCs are citing one another too. And that should all be included in how we think about the archival processes of hip hop and how we think about preserving hip hop and who is actually doing the preserving outside of the institutional frame.
Yeah. I mean, just alongside that, your Easy Mo B example is a great one. And I think it might be in the Jason Knorr and Mary Fogarty chapter about dance videos. And I think they posed the question, like, can you something to the effect of can you dance in the archive or can one dance in the archive? And I a little bit of what I think they're getting at is, it may be literal. Like, can you have a freestyle dance cipher in an archive? But the other thing I think is about, the accumulation of moves and the establishment and learning of those foundations and how those get preserved and passed along and made publicly accessible as knowledge,
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Another really persistent theme in the book is the locality of hip hop culture. So how do individual hip hop archives reflect and preserve this locality? And this is, of course, archives broadly defined. And are there any particular examples from the book or from the archival practitioners who contributed to the book that you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's absolutely true. I mean, one of my first book is The Hood Comes First on Race, Place, and Space in Hip Hop. This idea of locality, in fact, is really crucial to the culture. You know, it starts, and it can be like what I call the hyper extreme local, you know, one's block, you know, literally the street corners where you spend your time, where you live, where your family and your nurturing juices and energies are based. It can be, you know, the scale of a city or a town. It can be regional, you know, it just sort of grows outwardly from there. But many, many things in hip hop do begin at this local basis. And I would say this is to some extent also true in archives. Way before we get to something like the Smithsonian Institution having hip hop within their hallowed halls, we've got people starting to, pulling things out of their closets and trying to say, like, you know, what can we do to create something that's community accessible, that's community responsive, that somehow tells our story within this larger frame of a, you know, national or global hip hop movement. And so almost all the hip hop archives and archival initiatives that we've encountered do have some sort of local seed. They begin locally. They begin with a small group of people putting their heads together and saying, A, we're getting old. B, we've been around long enough. Often we're not being represented or noticed sufficiently. And we want to, you know, this is one of the ways that we can ensure that we're part of the narrative, part of the story, and we're not overlooked. And so, you know, I'm here in Boston, so I can point to Pacey Foster, the founder and director of the Massachusetts Hip Hop Archive. And, you know, as that chapter indicates, it's quite by serendipity that he ends up with a collection of hip hop cassette tapes from a local community campus radio station. Knowing the value of what he has historically and in terms of knowledge, but not sure how to bring it out. What do you do with it? How do you preserve it? How do you both protect it, but also make it community responsible or responsive and accessible? And so, you know, he and called in the pioneers, called in the veterans, called in people from the public library, Boston Public Library, from his institution, University of Massachusetts in Boston. You know, so he got people at all different levels and all kinds of representation, you know, footing in the community saying, okay, we've got this thing that's unique and distinct to Boston, and it tells our story. Let's work. And you know, that's something that I think every city, I'm realizing now, every city or archival initiative has some version of that narrative.
Yeah. In Toronto, I mean, the scenario was a little bit different, but I was on radio and I had a ridiculous collection of demo tapes, flyers, magazines I was collecting. And at one point in time in the classroom, not having materials to teach with, I was clearly like, we need to focus on Toronto history, because this is right before Twitter came about. And I was like, oh, you know, things are moving quickly. MySpace is disappearing. You know, you have Facebook is gathering steam. And what's going to disappear next other than all of our histories that were recorded on paper in the last decade, right? So that's really the story of Toronto hip hop only started gathering attention, you know, after 2010, after realizing that, you know, there are all of these new technologies that are just creating new data piles and just burying anything that was not recently digitized or not digitally born. Montreal is now doing a lot of that homework. Ottawa is also doing a lot of the homework. They're gathering. Ottawa just had an amazing, it's actually still up, an amazing exhibition called 83 Till Infinity. We should definitely put a link to listeners. It's in Ottawa up until the middle of February. And, it was the community came together and crowdsourced a whole bunch of historical objects and items. And they collaboratively put this exhibition together at the Ontario Art, the Ottawa Art Gallery. So slowly but surely, local communities are coming together to capture their history. And it's great to see that because Toronto can't tell Ottawa's historical, trajectory. And of course, Montreal being a more multilingual city than Toronto, there's, we just can't. There's so many differences that each story is so layered and rich that they deserve their own space and their own leaders.
I'm just gonna, it's like the people listening won't see this, but I'm holding up the book. So these CD, I mean, cassette tapes here are from Toronto and Mark's collection, and this one over here is from the Massachusetts Hip Hop Archive. We wanted to make sure that we actually at some point had images of material that was foundational to our own localities.
I love that. There will be a picture of the book on the episode page.
All
So
right.
they'll be able to see it. Also, if you want to see it up closer, you can buy the book. Yeah, I'm always struck. I mean, the answers you just gave in the book, just in my work and in the many archives I interact with, sometimes it's not even a local story. It's one person saying, "Oh, I have something important," and just getting a bunch of other people saying, "Oh, this is cool. I wanna put some labor into that." Mark, you kind of, I think, alluded to some of the challenges in archiving musical heritage, hip hop. So I want to ask about that explicitly, especially if anyone listening is working in this area or adjacent, well, just what are the challenges?
Oh wow. There's a couple. I could off the top, when your histories are contentious, right? And when you're not trying to document the winner only and you want to get all the voices in there, you have to have these polyphonic and polyvocal histories, or else you're going to have someone boasting about something that you can't verify. Unless the folks that were there at the time were like, wait a minute, I don't think it was, I don't think the crowd was exactly reacting to you that way. But the challenges are is that there's old relationships too. And those old relationships come with bad experiences that people sometimes don't get over, and digging that up. When we want to find the gold, we find everything else when we start digging up old stories and histories and people's feelings. Sometimes it's part of the story. So there is no rational and an objective way to say this is the history without having people, without it having affect, when people saying, oh, I remember that time when, and you fill in the blank, or this was the greatest experience, and this was my least great, my least wonderful experience at a concert or working with a band or a group or a crew or something like that. So, I mean, in the Canadian context, I can say really clearly, one of the greatest challenges is living beside the world's largest media source, Canadian media struggles to tell a Canadian story. And they've embraced the work I'm doing, but in terms of why this work never happened before, there aren't a lot of avenues to tell Canadian stories about its own history. And a lot of our media landscape is dominated by American media outlets who are not interested in a Canadian story, at least not before Drake, right? So those are some of the difficulties. I mean, the hardest, I think I would say the hardest thing is to convince people that the things that they have are valuable and important. You know, so people are throwing out old radio shows that they've recorded. They're dumping their cassettes, a lot of stuff that they feel like is obsolete. It has so much value, and until you show folks that these are all of the ways that we can rethink and reuse these materials and tell different kinds of stories about the history of hip hop, then that's the first hurdle to get over. And people see, oh, other people are interested in my collection, and that's kind of where the ball starts rolling.
If I can jump in, one of the to Mark's point, I've seen it a number of times here in at the Massachusetts Hip Hop Archive. I call it kind of relitigating old beefs, old conflict, and these guys come together and it can be kind of good natured saying, well, what you're describing isn't quite how I remember it. And so the archival artifacts can sometimes provide evidence, right? That this is, ostensibly standing in as a truth statement, right? Which we know that that can also be problematic, which I think is, from a theoretical perspective is fascinating, right? That the artifacts are ostensibly they're being positioned as evidence of truth. And so there'll be that, but at the same time, there's in the gatherings at the archives, meetings, and when there's archival events that that have been hosted by the archive here in the city, it's like a family reunion. I swear, people come together, and then the oral history starts happening. People are just like the reminiscence, the nostalgia, the recall, and to Pacey Foster's credit, but this is going on in other places as well. Try and record that, trying to get that down, so that then also becomes part of the archival record, right? As people just like spontaneously saying, "Oh, I remember this," or the recall that comes up when they see either an object or some video footage of some sort. And then the other part I'd add to that, which I hadn't foreseen, but it's a beautiful thing, is the way some of the archival events can be memorials for those who are no longer here to represent themselves, but they show up in the archive. They're dead, they're past, but they're not, and their memory is resonant, and they were and remain important to the community, and the archive keeps that alive, keeps them alive as memory at least. And it's a beautiful thing. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, I always say archiving is death work, which is not something I was ready for when I became an archivist. I want to, if anyone listening has picked up the book or is planning to, I do want to highlight one chapter that really I thought spoke very powerfully to this. I'll just, the name of the chapter will give it away. It's chapter 7, The Ballad of Grandmaster PH, Contesting Narratives and Lost Archives in Philippine Hip Hop. Really, really fascinating. A world I knew nothing about, but really a well done chapter on sort of these, there's a lot of stuff in the world that was never recorded, so to speak, not in sort of, and in this not in this evidentiary way. And this chapter really gets at that quite well. I wanted to go back to one thing you said, Mark, about convincing people that their material is important, which is one hurdle. And I think another hurdle when people are sort of thinking in terms of institutional archives is there's a real lack of capacity, right? A lot of archives are very, especially formats that they don't have the ability to digitize or care for properly, etc. The archive where I work, world's largest archive of Eastern European Jewish history and culture, right? And we have, to my knowledge, the largest Jewish sound archive in the United States. And we get a lot of people who want to donate records that we have. And they are cool and they are rare, but we just already have them. And frankly, nobody, like very, very few places want Yiddish records, right? There's just not a major interest in that. And I don't know what will come of this, but I one of a potential donor whose collection we couldn't take, or just, somebody who's donated to the archive was like, what if you sent duplicates to assisted living facilities and nursing homes and things like that, so that people can kind of, it's the music of their youth, right?
Yeah.
That could be cool. And I was like, wow, that could be cool. What a great thing that would be for these records that are not, we're not gonna take them and archive these particular instances, these LPs that are in this person's house, right? We have them, but they can still be used if we can figure out other uses for them. So
Yeah.
I don't know. That might be completely irrelevant to the hip hop question. You might be stuck at that first, people wanting to preserve their stuff, period. But just working with a lot of donors, you really, I mean, so many archives are so kind of stretched in terms of labor and money, and they are constantly having to say no to material that they really do want and just can't responsibly steward.
Yeah. Because hip hop emerged outside of institutions, there are, and in a smaller country than the United States, there aren't a lot of people that are like, here's my collection, because there aren't institutions that they know will celebrate them, right? But for, I can tell you two experiences. One is, I remember telling someone during the pandemic that I didn't have capacity to take all of their cassettes. And he's a DJ. He's still performing. I see him at events. He comes to our events, but he was so deeply offended that I said, I won't do that again, because it really sort of shines this kind of negative light on Northside hip hop. But I have been trying to work around some of that by ensuring that as much things as I get digitized, and people see it out in the world and they know it has a life somewhere. But that's really one of the workarounds, because most people are, on the scale that I work, think of the scale of Canada as one tenth the size of the United States, which means for every independent record where there's 1,000 copies or 5,000 copies made in a city like Chicago or Detroit, then there's 500 copies made in Toronto or less. So people are in no way trying to give up some of these things that have a lot of meaning to them. They also weren't mass collected, right? So there wasn't a bunch of people buying these records because they were at the front of the store and on sale. They were deeply committed to the scene, and they knew the artists on, more likely than not, they had some sort of deep connection to the song or the album or the piece of vinyl. So giving that stuff up is not, yeah, it's usually not at the top of people's priority list. But going to your other question, the other difficulty, once you get people engaged in archival work, is that it's hard for some people to imagine value outside of market terms. They think, oh, this is going to be worth a lot of money. Yeah, it might be worth a lot of money to five people, but 50,000 other people won't care about it, And trying to get people to understand, well, it would be really, really important that your item or your histories are shared with the other 5,000 or 50,000 people. Like there's public discourse to create, and getting people to imagine outside of like, oh, how much can I sell this poster for? How much can I sell this cassette for? Which, while I don't want to disregard that, most artists don't have pensions, especially if you're performing in the 80s. So I get it. Like, there's a real fiscal reality there. But when you're working at such a small scale, then sometimes it's really difficult to try to help people imagine how this thing could be valuable to a bunch of other people, especially if there is no acquisition fund. Sometimes there are acquisition funds, but many times there aren't.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals.
Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And do you find that digitizing, people are more willing to, is it like a lending situation? You digitize stuff and give it back?
Yeah, I do my best not to keep stuff. People will will donate stuff they'll say, please just hold on to this because I don't know what will happen to it if you don't hold on to it, which will. But if I ask someone about their collection or if they offer something up, I'll say, yeah, I'll digitize it for you, but I want to give it right back to you.
Okay, understood. You know,
because these things have deep memories for many people. Because if you were collecting hip hop or if you were into hip hop in the 1980s, it wasn't everywhere. So you were a dedicated fan and you were doing research and you were going to spots and so your memories are baked into those cassettes and those posters and those t-shirts in a way that may not be the same when you could buy a Biggie Smalls t-shirt at H&M today.
Right.
But if you were in Toronto in 1994, he came to Toronto once. And if you have the flyer from that event or the ticket stub from that event, you know, there's no other way to hold that memory for some people, you know.
One of the other things, as I'm thinking about this too and listening to Mark describe it, is, you know, age is a factor. And it's like, you know, when hip hop began, it was made by four, you know, young folks, right? And so some of these cats who came in, and we call them, you know, hip hop and rap celebrities, you know, people like LL Cool J on the larger scale, you know, they were 16, 17 when they came in, and some people younger than that. And so the oldest people in hip hop, like the actual true pioneers that people would all kind of point to and say, yep, they're the guys, they're not 70 yet. And so the culture is in a certain way still kind of young, in the sense that people have this stuff, they've accumulated it, but they haven't quite gotten to this point of like, I need to dispense of it, I need to dispose of it, I need to clear out the house. Or there's not like this secondary point where you can give your seconds to a senior living facility. You know, we're not there yet. And so this isn't, you know, I won't call it a predicament, but it, you know, this is one of the ways we have to look at it as well. It's like, you know, hip hop in the US began roughly, you know, 1973, 74, but hip hop in, you know, in different parts of Europe and other parts of the world really didn't take off until maybe 89 or so. Right. And those slippages and those discrepancies actually begin to matter from an archival, you know, an archival perspective.
Yeah, it's not very long ago. Yeah. I want to go back to this question of value, market value and non-market value. In the introduction, you write about this transformation of hip hop history from subject to object, which I thought was really interesting. And you were specifically writing about these auctions at places like Sotheby's of hip hop memorabilia. But I think in a lot of ways, a lot of archives facilitate that process, not maybe specifically hip hop, if we're not looking at a kind of institutional hip hop archive, but whatever history they're working with, this transformation from subject to object. And I think that there are a lot of valid critiques of that transformation that archives facilitate. So how can archival practitioners or educators, curators, whoever, ensure that hip hop history remains the subject, so to speak? And if the answer is like, don't put it an institutional archive, that's cool too. Maybe it's unavoidable. But I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Where do you want me to take this one?
I mean, I'll just jump in. Like, yeah, just really quick, just like make sure that any archive, you know, hip hop archive is community responsive and that it's a community accessible operation. You know, that's one of the ways that, you know, just make sure that there's community buy-in, people understand what's happening to the artifacts and the material, and that they know that it's there anytime for them to sort of plug into and to engage with, whether it's for, you know, reflection, nostalgia, entertainment, or research, whatever it might be. I mean, I think that's one of the ways to make sure that it remains connected to a hip hop culture, which is say it's not objectified.
Yeah, and I would say that practitioners need to continue to see their practice not solely as an entertainment function, you know, to see their practice and their engagement with the history of the culture, because they're all doing the homework. They're studying the greats. They know the lyrics, they know the dance moves, they know the scratching techniques. But to very consciously, when archiving hip hop, to be inclusive of those things, as as Diana Taylor suggests, that repertoire is a kind of expressive behavior and performance. It's a kind of episteme, right? It's a way of knowing, it's a way of analyzing the world, and having that sit alongside the boxes and the folders and the copies and the traditional ways that archiving happens, keeping those things in tension, I think is fruitful, because hip hop, if it cannot become this objectified, completely known thing out of a box, right? Like it becomes known by doing the dance move. It becomes known by scratching the record, and allowing those two very different preservation methods to exist alongside one another, I think is going to help us not imagine that we can know hip hop from studying papers, you know? Like sometimes that involves talking to the people, it involves going to an event, watching how the art forms are performed, to give you a more wholesome view of what the culture is about.
One a quick example, it's an anecdote in some of my research that I've been doing, interviewing individuals, and I won't name names, but I know who everybody is. But it was at the launch of the Cornell Collection at Cornell University. They had a big, symposium and, panels with academics and scholars and artists, practitioners, pioneers. It was really quite something. And you can find this online as well. But in one of the panels, somebody was up on the panel speaking at length about one of the pioneers, and the pioneer was in the audience, and the pioneer stood up and said, "Why are you talking about me like I'm dead? Like I'm right here. And I'm still doing this. I should be up there on stage talking about my own self," right?
Wow.
And it hushed the room, but I think it also spoke a kind of truth to what archives are, what they do, what they can do. And I think also to some of the early dilemmas of a hip hop archive is like, these cats are still around. They're still practitioners and active. And they are not going to be objectified, and they are going to, aggressively stand up and resist that.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you didn't get to see, Murray, in my first exhibition, when we opened the doors, I had people from the hip hop community walking in with their artifacts, and they were putting it on the wall themselves, and there was space for them to do that. And then they took cue cards and they narrated their own. So they were diffusing the power of the archive and of the curator, me, doing this kind of work. But it was very much about, I'm not in this story. And it wasn't like, why are you excluding me? I was like, it was more about, the doors are open, let's do this together.
Cool.
You know, you guys were there, I'm younger than you. You know, I'm creating the infrastructure, let's create the story together. And that could be a methodology that, that can be imagined in many of these. I imagine this might have happened, and something similar would happen in Ottawa and in a lot of these other cities. People feel comfortable, and there's a community vibe that you can walk into the exhibition and say, here's my art piece, here's my first graffiti piece, here's my newspaper article, mm-hmm. and be inclusive, and have them part of the historical record.
Well, this is one of the things I think does come up in the book. We talk about, kind of the idea of hip hop bum rush in the archive, If putting up a graffiti piece on a wall is a certain kind of appropriation of public space, so like coming in with something and, just actually literally putting it up on an archive, wall or some sort of display, that's totally in keeping with that. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
I have found that community archives are much better at that. I mean, I've certainly been involved in exhibitions where we actively invited people to donate if they had relevant. It's a lot of sort of social movement history. So if people have relevant material, or I've seen a lot of exhibitions where there is a dedicated space if someone wants to do an oral history, things like that. But I think it goes back to this death work thing in a way, this idea that if you're in an archive, it's because maybe you're not literally dead, but something has ended. And I can see how people who are involved, who are, you know, doing hip hop, come to these exhibitions and they're like, I'm not dead. I'm still here. Yeah, that could be.
But, you know, it kind of happened to me in terms of someone coming to the exhibition and feeling like, you know, is this the end of hip hop? Like, why is it in an exhibition? You know, and if you follow Stuart Hall in constituting an archive, you know, there's a certain, we're moving from innocence to consciousness of the historical process. It's a maturation where, you know, that community starts to realize that, oh, we're not kids anymore. Oh, we did stuff and that stuff is disappearing, you know? So for some people, they know it's an epoch, but they're not quite sure how to, you know, articulate that, oh, something dramatic has changed. It's like, yeah, we're no longer innocent actors in the making of this history. It's made and it's out there, and it should be articulated and captured in a way that can be shared with other folks. So it's a difficult moment, because as you keep coming back to this idea of death in the archive, you know, hip hop really challenges that notion, just like that pioneer in the audience, because there are so many, and I'll give you a great example. You know, for many great turntablists, there's a routine by a turntablist who's passed away now called DJ Rock Raider, where they scratch over their shoulders and they move the mixer with their shoulder blades. That routine is like canon now, you know, and he's passed and it's an honorific act, but he's alive. Yeah. You know, his artistic innovations are alive. It's speaking to young people, because we're still trying to do what he was doing, you know, in the 90s when he came up with this move. And I like to think about the performative aspect of hip hop culture, that this thing can't die if people are still citing your rhymes, if people are still trying to do the head spin or do certain dance moves that, you know, might have been popularized by like B-Boy Frost or something like that, who's passed. So there's something beautiful there in that tension.
And in that, not just doing the move or something like that, but also doing it to the same jam, like from, you know, from that period. Yeah. So like, you know, they're using the same rhythms that were maybe used 25 years ago to both learn the foundations and learn the original moves, and then to maybe, you know, add their piece to it and, you know, take it a little bit further. But the jam is canon. And both DJs and dancers in that case, you know, they both have to be cognizant of that.
I think this goes back to, Murray, your very first response to this question about history going from subject to object to subject. I now forget which direction, but you said, you know, you said archives can be places of research, but also, you know, if they're open to the communities they are representing, they can be places of entertainment and places of community. And I think a lot of archives are really stuck. They're research. They see themselves as research institutions, and maybe they are research institutions. And I think a lot of there's a lot of talk, as I'm sure you're aware, as I'm sure anyone listening is aware, of, you know, drawing in broader communities, people who are not academics, et cetera, et cetera. Like, not everyone wants to do research per se, right? Like, it's a very specific thing. So any sort of artifact, that's a very particular use for it. And can archives begin to understand themselves as places where knowledge is transmitted in a completely different way? Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what you both just spoke to. but I think for the kind of institutional archives, that's something to think about. And I also, this is in response to something Mark said like 7 minutes ago, but I still have this chapter open, so I will note it for the listeners. Mark, what you said about the sort of the information that people need to have to understand these histories. If anyone is interested in that from a sort of practitioner level, might I recommend chapter 12, Rap Cubano in the Archive, The Immaterial Paradox, which is a relatively wonky, as this book goes, sort of how did somebody actually catalog and what information did they include and things like that. Definitely thought-provoking if anyone listening is actively cataloging or archiving musical material. All right, we are running out of time, so I'll ask one last question, and this is the classic New Books Network closing question. Is there anything you're working on now that you'd like to share?
I think I'm working on a bunch of things, but I'm working on promoting this book and starting some conversations, but I'm thinking of the follow-up to this book that won't be, for me, it won't be in a book format, right? It will be a creative production. That is, you know, I'm in the middle of touring an exhibition on graffiti in Canada. And it's on its way back to Canada from overseas. And so I'm focused on that, but I'm trying to think of more creative responses to part two to this book, because I feel like there's a conversation we still want to have that with people that may not dive deep into this book. Is something that around music and going back to some of my early DJing days, thinking about sampling and how do we think about memory and memory work in a way that is not reduced to being within the clutches of an archival institution, right? And hip hop has, there's multiple ways that hip hop does that. So I'm spending time thinking through some of those issues right now before I produce something next.
And you know, in Mark's comment, just to sort of draw attention to it, that, you know, while he's you know, the ace Canadian and Toronto archivist of hip hop, he also does curatorial work and, you know, almost like museum type stuff, and does put together these amazing displays that throughout Canada and that have been in London and in Japan. And that's another part, is making sure that, in fact, that, you know, the material is, you know, presented in a much more widely. So it's available, you know, for almost, you know, as a touring show in some ways, and a touring exhibit, which I think is an important piece of it. And not a lot of archives that I've seen do it that way and do it as well.
But it's too hard. It's a lot of work. Yeah, that's no why doubt. I didn't know how to do it. Yeah.
I don't know how you do it, brother, but, you know.
Barely. So that's what I'm working on.
Yeah, on my side, I'm continuing, you know, from this project, our friend Courtney Chartier, who's a former president of Society of American Archivists, she put out a call for papers for a special issue of, how is it called?
Archival Organization?
The Journal of Archival Organization, yeah. A special issue on hip-hop archiving. And so, you know, drawing on some of the material in my own research that didn't fit into this book, I submitted a chapter for that. And I don't know where that project's at, but it's going to be great. And it'll be just another kind of amplifier of some of the issues for sure. And then my longstanding project, which also has, you know, a lot of overlapping components here, Old in the Game, Time, Age, and Aging in Hip Hop, which is really about this notion of who are these pioneers? How are pioneers identified? What is the whole discourse and terminology of being a pioneer in the culture? And what are some of the implications of it? And what are the conflicts that go along with it between or among pioneers, among, you know, creating generational dissonance, those sort of things. And so that's the major project I'm working on right now. And I've got a almost completed manuscript, and I'm getting old in the game just working on it, and I'm ready to have it done, and hopefully it'll find traction and get out there. And then I don't know. Then I, you know, like Mark, I sort of look at what's going on in the field, look what hip hop's doing, and try and catch the vibe and see if there's work I can do to help build the culture, because that's really what it's about. In an interview with Chuck D at one point, he said that at his stage in his career, he's in service to hip hop. Everything he does is really just about creating the culture and making sure it endures, building it, making sure the history is preserved and not forgotten. And I think that's noble work. And so I think, you know, I think I can probably, you know, Mark and I both share that that's what we're about.
Yeah, most definitely.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for taking the time this evening.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
So much for having us.
Yeah.